Welcome to the Daily Stoic Podcast, where each weekday we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, a short passage of ancient wisdom designed to help you find strength and insight here in everyday life. And on Wednesdays, we talk to some of our fellow students of ancient philosophy, well-known and obscure, fascinating and powerful. With them, we discuss the strategies and habits that have helped them become who they are, and also to find peace and wisdom in their actual lives. But first, we've got a quick message from one of our sponsors. The Stoics talk, of course, about self-improvement a lot. That is the purpose of philosophy in many ways, is to get better each and every day. And I think the Stoics were pretty unanimous in their belief that reading is a way to do that. And that's why I love today's sponsor, Blinkist. Blinkist is a way to get better, smarter, and to do it faster. In 2022, Blinkist has takeaways from some of the best books on the topic of self-improvement, books that were written by friends of mine that I've recommended many times. Mark Manson's The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, James Clear's Atomic Habits, Tim Ferriss's The 4-Hour Body, and more. They also, of course, have my books as well. When I read a book, what I'm really looking for is like one nugget, one insight, one thing I can take away. And if you don't have time to read as much as I do, Blinkist is a great way to just get that. These sort of 15-minute summaries of these books, interviews with the authors where they really go in-depth at the core, the crux of what the author is trying to say. Now, I don't think that's enough. I think you should also go read the book. But Blinkist is a great way to tackle reading in 2022, to read more, to read faster. One of the things I do when I tackle a really big, complicated book is I want to read a review, listen to a summary, read the Wikipedia page so that when I actually do get the book, I know what I'm looking for and I've got a base of knowledge to start with. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/stoic to start your free 7-day trial and you can get a 25% off Blinkist Premium membership. That's Blinkist, B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/stoic to get 25% off a free 7-day trial. Go to Blinkist.com/stoic. I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit, FIT/dailystoic, and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now. All great stories have one thing in common. Nobody would choose to be prevented from getting what they want. But think about all the great stories. The Odyssey, Moby Dick, Star Wars, Huckleberry Finn, Where the Wild Things Are, The Wizard of Oz. They all have one thing in common. Character wants something, and the world tries to prevent them from getting it. And it's the tension here, what the character wants and everything that prevents them from getting what they want, that drives the story, that keeps hold of an audience's attention, and ultimately teaches the timeless lessons embedded in great stories. And this is why the Stoics loved reading fiction, why they loved theater. They loved quoting plays and referencing successful and tragic heroes, real or fantastical. Because stories teach, stories inspire. Stories, as Marcus Aurelius wrote, remind us of what can happen, and that it happens inevitably. And if something gives you that pleasure on the stage, it shouldn't cause you anger on this one. They remind us that life without tests and challenges is a life without growth or improvement. And they remind us that the obstacle is the way, that adversity is an opportunity, and that it sometimes is a good thing to be prevented from getting what you want. Take the story of Epictetus. As we recently talked about, Epictetus was born into circumstances filled with forces working against the most primary of human desires, freedom. Epictetus was the child of a slave woman, then the purchased property of a violent master, then the subject of a brutal law that made it impossible for slaves to be freed before their 30th birthday. Fate tested Epictetus with one blockade after another. But in having to struggle with this, Epictetus managed to discover a new and deeper and more profound kind of freedom, the empire that rests between our ears, inside our souls, within our bodies. And it has been this example that has inspired millions, including Marcus Aurelius, in the years since. Well, it's also what I'm talking about in the new story I've been working on, the girl who would be free. It's this illustrated fable of Epictetus's life. I've been asked by so many people, after The Boy Who Would Be King, if there was a version of Stoicism that they could teach their daughters. I think Stoicism is universal. Musonius Rufus, Epictetus' teacher, would say that gender has nothing to do with virtue. But I do get the idea of representation. And that's why I decided to build this story around Epictetus as a young girl. What did she need to learn? How did this happen? Who taught her? What can her experiences teach us? And these are timeless questions. And I think questions best delivered in the form of a story, in a fable. That's why I wrote the book. I illustrated it with my friend Victor Juhas, who did The Boy Who Would Be King, and it's now available for pre-order. We produced it here in the U.S., printed it here in the U.S. It's been its own set of obstacles. It took about 6 months longer than we wanted because of this global printer shortage. But if you pre-order The Girl Who Would Be Free now through the Daily Stoic store before July 8th, you can get the audiobook and the ebook for free. You can also get The Boy Who Would Be King for 50% off. And if you order a signed copy of The Girl Who Would Be Free, you can get The Boy Who Would Be King for free. I'd really love for you to check it out. You can go to dailystoic.com/girl to check it out. Can't wait to see what you think. I'm really proud of this one. And I can't wait for you to share it with your family, with anyone that you think might benefit from Epictetus's incredible journey. I am a big fan of today's guest. I really enjoyed his first book, Peak Performance, which I sell here at the Painted Porch. It's how much I like it. He followed that up with a book called The Passion Paradox, which is actually really similar to, which explored some of the ideas that I was exploring in Ego is the Enemy. I have a chapter on not being passionate. Of course, we think passion is really important, but it's in fact kind of a volatile fuel, as the Stoics would say. And you have to get it under control or it will explode all over you. And his new book, Do Hard Things, is one I was very excited to read. And I wanted to have Steve Magnus on the podcast because in addition to being an author whose books have more than 250,000 copies in print, Steve's also a world-renowned performance expert. And as it happens, a whistleblower in the world of sports. He took down an abusive and problematic coach in the Nike running world, which we get into in today's episode. And I think this is something that is important when we think about philosophy, that if it doesn't inform and shape our own behavior, the ideas we study, the things we talk about, what good is it? And I think Steve is an interesting example then of someone who not just talks the talk, but walks the walk and did so, as we talk about in today's episode, in a costly way. It was not an easy experience. It was not an experience that was particularly rewarding, at least as far as recognition or appreciation. He says that you wouldn't have traded it for anything, but it's a reminder, as the Stoics say, that you may do the right thing and not get what they call the third thing, the recognition or appreciation or respect, at least immediately. And these are all some of the awesome topics that we talk about in today's episode. You can see Steve's writing everywhere from Forbes to Sports Illustrated, Men's Health, and a variety of other outlets. He's been featured in The New Yorker, The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, and ESPN, the magazine. You can go to his website at stevemagnus.com. You can follow him on Instagram at Steve Magnus. And you can check out his new book, Do Hard Things, Why We Get Resilience Wrong, and the Surprising Science of Real Toughness. I think this is an important bit of color and insight into what the Stoics talk about. It does remind me of a related book that I carry here at the Painted Porch called That One Should Disdain Hardships by Musonius Rufus. He's not saying don't do hardships. He's saying exactly what Steve is saying. Do hard things. So check out Steve's new book, which has a cover blurb from Malcolm Gladwell, which are not easy to get. As Malcolm Gladwell says, in Do Hard Things, Steve Magnus beautifully and persuasively reimagines our understanding of toughness. This is a must-read for parents and coaches and anyone else looking to prepare for life's biggest challenges. I love that. Enjoy, and thanks to Steve for coming on the podcast. All right, man. Well, I love the book. Thank you for sending it to me.
Well, thanks a lot. That's great to hear.
Yeah, I've loved your other stuff too. All right, so here's where I wanted to start, because I think there is a stoicism connection to do hard things, which maybe people wouldn't see. One of my favorite lines from Seneca says, how do you know that you're making progress as you study the philosophy? He says, I know I'm making progress because I'm a better friend to myself. And so when I think about do hard things and what the book is actually about, because it's not actually an admonishment to just like whip yourself or push yourself. When I think about what it means to be a friend to yourself, I think about it in both senses of the word. So a friend encourages you, pushes you, gets you to see your true value and capabilities and potentials. They're the one cheering for you. They're the one rooting for you. But they're also the one that doesn't let you beat the shit out of yourself. They're the ones that encourages you to ask for help or perhaps offers help unsolicitedly. So I feel like what you're saying when you say that we should do hard things, it's really it's not just hard physical things, but it's also the hard emotional things. And it may be the hardest thing of all, which is being kind to yourself.
I love that. You know, I've studied the Stoics a little bit, and that resonates completely, because what it is you're sitting with that tension.
Yes.
Right. And that is the space, I think, that is often the space for growth, is it's sitting with this idea that, yes, we need to do difficult things and go towards this discomfort. And often the things where the most growth opportunities are a little bit uncomfortable and the things that we often want to avoid. But at the flip side of that is as well as that friendship piece you brought in is that to be able to go to that place, to be able to like navigate and come out on the other side, we also have the environment and support to do so.
Well, you talk about this early in the book. We had this, like, I think when we think about like elite performance, we had this stereotype of the coach being the bully, the aggressor. We think of Tom Izzo like in the face, yell, you know. And perhaps that's what we think like philosophy or self-improvement or even that voice in your head is supposed to mimic. And in the way that we kind of pick models or representations from culture and movies and sports, I feel like we have internalized that image of the coach. Even if one, it's not actually like representative or the most effective. And even if it did get the results, is it the best way to go through the world as a human being?
Exactly. No, I think you're spot on there, because it is the voices in our head are like they have to come from somewhere.
Yeah.
And what inevitably happens is they come from models that we see in the world, the coaches we have, the teachers we experience, all those good things. And I think often what happens is, just like you pointed out, we grab onto these models that are incredibly appealing in some ways, because they almost get to this like natural part where it's like, oh, of course, I want someone to like, you know, be in my head telling me, you know, this is what you do, like get your shit together, all this good stuff. But often like that backfires. It's almost like it's this selective pressure where we see someone who does that and says, oh, that's the way. And then we ignore all these other successful people, coaches, et cetera, who aren't sitting there yelling in our face and get the job done and win the championships and all that good stuff. And that doesn't, you know, that doesn't appeal. It's the classic, you know, the John Wooden versus Bobby Knight.
Where who won John, more?
Right, exactly. John Wooden is the man, the master. Yet, like, how often do we use him as an example versus some of these other coaches who won some, but like did it in a completely different way? And I think that does us a disservice.
Well, I think one is much more cinematic, invisible. That's probably part of it. But like, it's weird because it just so doesn't jive with anyone's own experience. Like, have you ever been screamed at into performing better? I can think of like, no, it doesn't work at all. And then there's this sense, I think it's almost like, you know, they've done studies where like, why do people reflect fondly on their time in a fraternity, let's say? It's usually because of the cognitive dissonance of like the pain they had to go through to get into said fraternity, right? And so I think it's like so many people grew up with shitty coaches who screamed at them that the idea that the younger generation should not have shitty coaches that scream at them seems almost unfair. And then it's like, well, wait, I just let them do this to me and it wasn't part of the process at all. Like, even coaches I know that aren't screamers, if you try to push them to criticize or, like critique another coach who does it that way, they're like hesitant to do it. Even though I think overwhelmingly, like we'd all agree that's not how you get good performance out of people.
Yeah. You know, the way I like to put it is, when's the last time you performed well out of a place of like just total fear?
Yes.
You know, it doesn't happen. Like, yes, we're going to have some sort of fear, but we tend to perform best when we're almost freed up. We have the freedom to explore our capabilities and like the security to do so. And whenever you put people in this place of like fear, admonishment, like punishment, et cetera, to the extreme degree, it just backfires. But I think you're right. I think it's part of like we all grew up a certain way. And then I think part of it is too, is from a leadership standpoint, what's the easiest thing or the easiest way to get control and power? It's to be a dictator, right? Because the other way requires, you know, oh, I have to cultivate relationships and develop buy-in. And that takes time and energy and effort. And when the power dynamics are skewed, like so often in sport and actually in business and leadership, like the cheap way is often like, well, forget this. I'm just going to be like this hard ass dictator and like tell these people what to do and that'll get the job done.
Yeah, I was reading this article recently and it was saying that like as a parent, you're never like excited that your kids misbehave, right? But they were like, it's actually in some ways a positive sign in that your kids think they can... it's safe for them to talk back to you. Like, so when you watch a kid who like never talks back, who always behaves, who never tests boundaries, you're almost certainly looking at a kid who is afraid of the two people or the one person they should not be afraid of. Right. And what does that, so like what you're judging as success, like look how quiet my kids are at dinner or whatever, you're actually indicting yourself. Right. And, But the alternative is to go, shit, well, that's going to mean my house is not as smoothly run or easy. It means I'm going to have to talk about things multiple times. It's going to mean I'm going to have to convince them why they shouldn't do something for reasons other than I'll make you pay for it. You know what I mean? And so, like you said, it's easier to be a dictator. It's actually harder to be... And no one's saying they have to be everyone's best friend, but it's actually harder to get real buy-in, real cultural buy-in than to use sort of force or punishment.
Yeah, I love the parenting discussions and literature on this subject, because it's just fascinating to me, because there's research behind what you just outlined there, which is if you look at, we're talking actual discipline and actual like ability to handle challenges, the parents who teach or like parent in a way that is just what you described, like where their kids are afraid, as soon as they're out of the house, as soon as they're in their first job, even in studies, if they go straight to the military, those people, those kids who like behave because of fear, they perform worse. They have less persistence when going into the job, and they tend to cause or create more trouble and have less discipline. And even a military standpoint, because they were doing it just out of a place of fear.
It's the only place left that you can get away with it too, right? We did this Daily Stoic Leadership Challenge a while back where we interviewed all these leaders. We did these interviews, and I interviewed a couple different generals in the Army, and one was in the Air Force, one was in the Army. And anyways, he's a 2-star general. And he's like, I've been doing this for like 40 years. He's like, I think I may, and he'd also served in combat, but he's like, I've maybe given 2 direct orders in my entire career. He's like, people think that in the military, you're like, you know, that it's the old school way. And they're like, oh, it works there. That's what you talk about, how like sports and the rest of the world, we take these lessons from the military, but it's really like what we saw in movies. It's not actually how it is. He's like, no, I have to ask people to do stuff. And there's this great Eisenhower quote where he says, leadership is the art of getting people to do things because they want to do them. And so it's like, if even in the military, they're not operating under force, they're having to appeal to self-interest, they're having to get buy-in, they're having to think about people as part of an organization and a team and think about their feelings, et cetera. Like, the idea that you're going to subject your 7-year-old to this strikes me as preposterous and of without value, because there's no other, what environment are you preparing them for in which someone's going to have a similar amount of command and control over them that's going to mimic this environment?
Exactly. And I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the favorite sections of the book to research was the military side, because we have so many misconceptions. And it's exactly what you said, is like we hold on to these ideas from movies we've seen and so forth that creates this story and narrative that just isn't real.
Yeah.
And you talk to, you know, high level military operators, you talk to people in the special forces, and they all say like, oh, no, it doesn't work this way. Like, you know, it doesn't work this way at all. Like, no, we're taught, like, we have choice and we're taught how to navigate these things. I mean, one of my favorite stats that I found out is that the U.S. Army is the nation's largest supplier of sports psychologists. Like, they employ the most. And it's like, why? Why are they employing all these, like, we'll say just like touchy-feely, like, this is how the brain works, this is how we perform. It's because they know it's freaking important.
Epictetus says that I delight in my improvement day to day. Well, today's sponsor, 10,000, has a mantra that's quite similar. Their mantra, better than yesterday, works perfectly with what we talk about here on Daily Stoic. Plus, I love their stuff. I've been wearing it ever since my friend Rich Roll turned me onto it. I love the interval short. I love their long sleeve shirt that they have. They've got a short sleeve I've been training in lately. They just make high-quality, great-fitting, comfortable running gear that's both well-suited to people who are serious, and then you can also just wear it around during the day. Their session short is great. The lightweight shirt is great. They've got all sorts of features. They've got the silver ion in it for odor protection. They've got no-bounce pockets. They've got breathable flyweight shell fabric. There's an optional liner that protects chafing and a bunch of the stuff. The shirts are lightweight and sweat-wicking. It doesn't matter what you do, whether you run or lift or train in jiu-jitsu or tactical training, you can find the stuff that you need from 10,000. And they believe in being better than yesterday, which, as I said, is the sort of stoic idea of continuous improvement, not overnight success. All their stuff's tested by great athletes. They asked me for some feedback, which I was happy to give. You can get free shipping and free returns and a lifetime guarantee from 10,000. And 10,000 is offering our listeners 15% off your purchase. You can go to 10,000.cc/stoic to receive 15% off your purchase. That's 10,000.cc, not .com, 10,000 spelled out .cc/stoic.
Yeah, like people have started. It's like, oh, it's the woke military. You know, they're going soft or whatever. And it's like, actually, no, it's the exact opposite. I remember I spoke at the Marine Recruiting Command. So these are the people who are having to recruit people to join at the officer level. So these, you know, for all the military academies, etc. And they were like, we're trying to poach people from Harvard and Yale. Like we're going after the best talent in the country with seemingly the worst offer, right? Like you're not going to get a job in an investment bank after this. Like you're going to go get shot at. They're like, if we scream at people, if we're horrible, no one will want to join. And I think this is also what they're calling the softening of the military is actually, no, this is what happens when you didn't draft people into the military against their will, when you're trying to appeal to people who are elite performers or want to be elite performers and are more representative of culture. Like they come, you know, like a significant percentage of the military is now female. They come from all different backgrounds. They don't want to be screamed at. They don't want to deal with your sexist bullshit or your racist bullshit. They're like, I willingly joined this. I can leave, right? And like, I know what this is costing you. Like it's the result of the leverage that talent has. And I think at the core of what we're talking about here is like talent is a critical thing. The idea that you would abuse it or mistreat it or overtrain it, et cetera, the way that the old model would do, whether it's in sports or military parent, it's not just naive. It's like self-defeating.
Yes. I think that is, talent is king. And in the old days, sometimes you could get away with it. And I tell the story of Paul Bear Bryant, famous football coach in there. And what struck me is early on in his career at Texas A&M, he's famous for doing these really difficult camps and all this stuff. But what struck me looking back is how much talent he lost. Like he had some of the best high school players in the country who quit because like, he wasn't like, it was really tough to be on the team. And they not just quit, they quit and then did other sports and became like all Americans and like successful. So it's not that they couldn't take it. They were highly successful. But the key was back in when he was coaching, like in the whatever 1950s and 60s, like he was getting a ton of talent and he could just do with, hey, okay, it's okay. You're the best running back in the country. Like, you're not going to go somewhere else and do things because sports was crazy. Nowadays, we can't get away with that.
Yeah.
Like, if you lose your top talent, you can't just replace them. It's like you're going to get someone who's not as good. And that's what I think we have to, you know, zooming out to outside of sports, that's one of the lessons that we often forget. And my wife is an elementary school teacher, and it drives me nuts because teaching is the worst at this, and that they get good talent and then they treat everybody the same and yeah. Like, you know, almost like trash and like, hey, we're going to micromanage you and not allow you to flourish. So they lose the amount of talent they lose in the first 5 years of teaching careers is astronomical. And then we sit back and we're like, well, why is the U.S. education system not, you know, not that great? And it's like, yeah, there's all these things and all these solutions. But the bottom line comes to it is like, you're not attracting good talent and then you're not giving them the room to flourish and grow because you have this kind of old school mindset. And that's, again, across the board, often what we see is if you're just like the military example you gave, is if you're like sticking to a model that treats people kind of not like decent human beings, you're going to lose that talent. And eventually, like, your performance is just going to plummet.
Yeah, I've gotten to know the folks at the Rams pretty well. And I think what's interesting about them, obviously, they have some of the largest budgets in sports because the owner is so wealthy. But they sort of like they're pretty well known for giving like large contract extensions to talent that's performing well. And people are like, why are you doing this? You have them under a contract. You don't have to do it. And they're like, but we want people to work here. Like, we want people to want to work here. And this is also how they've been able to pick up talent, like, that's left other teams where they've been unhappy. They're like, I'm going to go somewhere else. I'm going to go to the Rams because they treat people well. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's not to say that it's easy to play for the Rams and that they're not going to get their money out of you. They are. But it's the understanding that, yeah, talent is king, and that you very rarely does talent, when it has options, is it going to sit around and be abused or mistreated or screamed at for no reason? That's just, nobody performs well under that.
And I think what you said there is the option. And that's what you see nowadays that we didn't have 40, 50 years ago, right? We have free agency in sports where people can choose where they want to go.
Yeah.
In college sports, you can now transfer freely. In the workplace, like, you don't go somewhere and have to work there for 30, 40 years. Like, you have the option, and the worker has a little bit more leverage. And I think that's why you're seeing, like, teams and organizations like the Rams that are like, oh, like, the key is, if we treat people decently, yes, like, we're going to have high expectations and work hard and all those things. But if we cultivate and create the environment that allows people to flourish, they're more likely to choose us and then stay with us. And I think that is often, like, that is the switch that we're seeing in modernity and the teams, organizations that succeed.
I like that you called it attention, though, because it's funny, right? Like, and he's probably wrong. You know, Elon Musk, his thing about, like, no more working from home. You know, you got to come back in the office. I think he is an example of what we're talking about. He's expecting everyone to work the imbalanced, dysfunctional schedule that he has. But it is true that as talented as people can be, this includes you as the individual, it's just because everyone's nice and supportive doesn't mean you're going to thrive. Like, the tension is, you have to create an environment in which people are supported, which they're not mistreated, where you understand that talent is king. And if left to our own devices, we do. I think it was Bill Walsh said that people are like water. We always seek lower ground, you know? So it's this tension of, like, don't be a hard ass, but also sometimes we need a hard ass.
Yeah. And this is that nuance, right? That is often lost in a social media world, where it's like, we can't swing to one extreme of the pendulum and think, like, oh, everybody happy go lucky, etc. You have to be in a situation where, I like to call it, like, that safety and security, and where you can flourish, but also that environment that is going to sometimes nudge, sometimes shove you to where you're, like, working towards growth. And I think, you know, you do this brilliantly in your own life, but we need to have something in our life that is, like, difficult, that pushes our bounds, that, like, makes us feel a little bit of anxiety, uncomfortableness, discomfort, all of those things. And that it is something that we have in control and that we can kind of, like, take on and challenge. And I think that is often the tension there, is that, like, it's not just, like, this happy-go-lucky place. It's like the Rams. Like, we're going to create an environment that is great, supportive, et cetera, but we're still going to coach you up.
And we're, and if you don't perform, we'll trade you and get in someone who's better.
Exactly. And I think it's like, it's, you need a little bit of that. You know, one of my good friends who's a coach at a high level professional sport always tells me, is like, it's that balance of doubt. Too much doubt can be, you know, just hold us back. But a little bit of doubt can be that nudge that says, like, okay, like, I got to stay focused. I got to keep my mind sharp. I got to be in this game. And I think that's that tension we're talking about.
Yeah. I've definitely been guilty of the, like, you know, somebody screws up and you're like, what the fuck were you thinking? Like, how could you do this? Right. And I've worked on it where, you know, I've tried to be more controlled. I try to think, you know, okay, let's go through this. What happened? And I've been amazed. Typically, it often is with younger people. And so it's like, I know when it's on me. Right. And then other times I'm like, I'm going to hand this calmly, patiently. I might be very upset. I'm not going to let it be known how upset I am when we're this through. And the person's still like, I just can't do this. I quit. Right. Like, so it's ironic that, like, you know, we're sort of talking about sometimes we can be too tough on people. And then I think it's also simultaneously true that there's kind of an epidemic of softness out there where people are not nearly as tough as they need to be to do the things that they say they want to do.
Yeah. So this is, again, one of those tensions that is really fascinating. And for a long period of time, for almost 10 years, I coached collegiately. So worked with 18 to 22 year olds. So I got to see this firsthand. And what I saw is that if you put people in the right environment and then can kind of nudge them towards, hey, we got to handle difficult things, they're capable of it. But it's almost like they're undertrained in that area because we've kind of have this society that like teaches them avoidance. And because of that, it's almost like that muscle is just atrophied. The example I like to give is in the sporting world, we'll use running, but I don't know if you've ever had this experience, Ryan. Maybe you were coming off an injury or sickness for a while and you get a little bit out of shape. And then that first like hard run you do back, that alarm in your brain just like goes off super early.
Sure.
And it's just yelling at you. It's saying like, slow down, stop. Like, this is really hard. But you know, because of experience, you're like, no, this isn't really that difficult. It's just, I haven't done it in a while.
Yeah, yeah.
And I tend to think like that's how a lot of younger people like face this world, is that when we haven't done anything difficult or challenging, that alarm goes off super early and they mistake it as like, oh, this is real. This is, I'm actually in danger, instead of the reality, which is like, no, you just haven't been in this spot for a long time or ever before. So if you just like sit with it and understand it, eventually you're going to learn like, hey, this isn't that bad. And I think that's the thing we're missing often.
Yeah. Seneca talks about how we treat the body rigorously so that it's not disobedient to the mind. It's like sort of, you have to cultivate a relationship with yourself where it's very clear who's in charge, right? That doesn't mean you never listen to the body when it says like, I'm hurt or I'm injured or whatever, but you do create a sort of a general sense that the body, it's like in my car, for whatever reason, the gas light goes on when it still has like 150 miles. It's like it gets good gas mileage. I'm used to that in other cars. I'm like, oh, I got to handle this right now. And it's like, no, you don't even know what you're talking about. I can drive this to work like 3 or 4 more days before I even need to think about this. You have to cultivate that, like, who's in charge? Is it the warning light or is it you?
Right. I love that analogy because it in this example with people, I think when we talk about being soft, it's as if you see that warning light and then you just spiral out of control, freak out, and like try and find the first gas station no matter what.
Yes.
And that's because the light is dictating. It's saying that it's the one in control of your actions and behaviors. And I think what we're saying is you can use that light as feedback.
Yeah.
You know, it can be, you know, tell you something, but you have to be the one in control where you say, okay, does that light mean I've got 20 more miles or 100 more miles? And like, you need to know that. And the only way you know that is if you get experience like being in that situation and like pushing the boundaries a little bit. And I think that is what we're missing often in the rest of life, is that we have to put ourselves in those experiences. And the example I like to give out, you know, in the athletic realm is, you know, again, I'll just go to running, is the longer you run, the more you realize like what the difference between pain and injury is, right? Pain is something temporary that I can control, that I can navigate, that if I keep going, it's not going to be a big deal. Injury is something that, you know, could set me back, that I need to listen to, that I need to heed right away, because, you know, if I keep pushing and going, I could put myself in even further damage. And like, understanding and picking apart that nuance is a skill that we have to develop. And I think it's, again, in the rest of our life, it's that same skill of what's real, What do I pay attention to versus what is like just my body telling me, you know, hey, this is kind of hard and I can just, you know, forget it, ignore it and keep going and keep moving on.
Your age, the Stoics would say, is just a number. A lot of people have a lot of years, Seneca says, and not much to show it. But I think the idea here is that we age at different speeds. And the date on your license may not represent your inner biological age at all or the extent of your experiences. And if you are looking for ways to extend your lifespan or slow down the aging process, well, the key to that is in your blood. And that's why today's sponsor, Inside Tracker, provides you with a personal plan to improve your metabolism, reduce stress, improve sleep, and optimize your health for the long haul. Created by leading scientists in aging, genetics, and biometrics, Inside Tracker analyzes your blood, your DNA, and your fitness tracking data, like from a smartwatch or a smartphone, to identify where you're optimized, where you're not. You'll get a daily action plan with personalized guidance on the right exercise, nutrition, and supplementation for your body. And you can add their product InnerAge 2.0 to any plan for a definitive calculation of your true biological age to see how you're aging from the inside out. For a limited time, you get 20% off the entire Inside Tracker store. Just go to insidetracker.com/stoic. That's insidetracker.com/stoic. I'm waiting on my DNA results right now to see about the changes that I'm going to make in my life. And I'm excited to see what you all come up with by trying Inside Tracker at insidetracker.com/stoic. You get 20% off using that landing page.
Yeah, it's like, what are the warning lights and which ones you listen to and when? Like, I remember I had this kid who worked for me and he made it like a week. And he was like, you know what? I don't think this is right for me. I'm worried about my work-life balance or whatever. And I'm like, first off, it's been a week. Second, you're 20, you know, you're single. What are you talking about? Right. And I'm not saying that we should all think about things the same way. It'd just be like, if you were talking to a woman who is 20 and she's like, I'm just really worried about my biological clock. And it's like, that is a concern, but you've got like 15 years before that's like an acute concern, right? Or whatever. Right. Like you're taking somebody else's warning light that you've heard about and making it your own as an excuse to not have to do this hard thing in front of you, right? Like what this kid was actually struggling with was going from college, I do this stuff for fun, I think I want to do this, to, all right, now this is on you, and people will be disappointed, upset, you know, frustrated with you if you don't deliver results in a short, like what he was really struggling with was the responsibility and the ownership, and decided to make it a work-life thing so he could turn away from it, right? And I think that's often what we do when we're struggling with hard things. There's everyone obviously has a limit, and there is this point where, yeah, you're about to go into rhabdo, or you're about to, you know, you're about to burn out, or, you know, whatever. There is stuff like that. And I've dealt with those myself. But often what we're really looking for, what we really want, is an excuse to not have to do the hard thing. And we're just looking for anything that will sell. Is, you know, that expression about will the dog hunt? We always want any dog that'll hunt that'll mean I don't have to be in this discomfort anymore.
Exactly. And I think the thing is, our brains are master storytellers. They will give us whatever excuse works. And the more uncomfortable we feel, the more our brain kind of defaults towards, I'm going to give you an out.
Yes.
Like, let me find the hole to step in so I can, I don't have to do this climb or whatever it is. Like, that's what our brains do. They're protective in nature. And I think part of it is like, when we're in those situations, is we have to slice and dice up is what's real and what's not. What is my brain freaking out and trying to protect me on versus what is, hey, this isn't really a big deal, or this is coming from this insecurity that I've never dealt with or faced before. And that is the tough part, I think, for a lot of a lot of people going from high school to workforce or college to work is that when we're not put in those positions, we have these kind of distorted expectations where, you know, oh, I'm going to go into the workforce and like everything's going to be great and I'm going to make a lot of money and move up and do all these things. And it's almost to me like stepping on the starting line of a marathon and expecting it like, oh, this is a piece of cake. I'm never going to go through a difficult time. I'm never going to struggle. Well, what happens? Like you get to mile 13 and it actually freaking hurts. And it's like, oh, there's a lot of doubt. Well, if you expected it to be easy, then the moment it starts getting difficult, your brain spirals towards what's the easiest excuse I can grasp onto. Same yes. thing here.
I think that's right. And I think the big thing that I find that we use is extrapolation, right? So we extrapolate this out a year or 10 years or 10 minutes. And we go, if it's like this for that amount of time, I will die, I will hurt, I will be laughed at, I can't cut it, whatever. So to me, you know, when people talk about being present, they think it's this kind of like monkish Buddhist Zen thing. But oftentimes, it's more, I think, rooted in this sort of Stoic idea of like, how tough can you be if you're just like, can I do this right now, right? Like the kid who is concerned about work-life balance is thinking like way off in the future. You know what I mean? He's not extrapolating out a learning curve, getting better, making adjustments, asking for, you know, changes. He's just extrapolating out, if it's hard right now, it will be hard forever. And I don't want to do a hard thing forever for uncertain rewards, right? And so I just go like, I'm just going to sit with whatever this is and understand. I forget which runner I heard this from, but something about like how it never always gets worse. Yes. Like sometimes it gets better, right? Or you get stronger, or the pain just, it turns itself down a little bit. Oftentimes I think what gets us into trouble and why we can't stay with difficult things is because we've done this insane extrapolation that really is a mechanism for creating outs, as you said.
Exactly. Actually, this weekend, I heard a brilliant story. So Des Linden won the Boston Marathon a couple years ago. And if you listened to what she said early on in that race, she actually turned to another American, one of her quote unquote teammates, and said, I feel really bad. This isn't my race. Like, let me help you. Like, do you need anything? Do you need any water? I can get it. Like, I'm not going to be able to finish this one. And this is at like mile 6 in the marathon. Well, because she's Des Linden, a pro marathoner, she like starts helping this athlete, like just runs next to them. Eventually, she starts feeling good and she wins the whole freaking thing. And I think that gets to this point, which you talked about, which is often we think we get stuck in that the here and now, if it's difficult, it's always going to be this way. And we just project out. And what happens there is that we almost like narrow our worldview. So we can't see anything in the future except for this is going to suck. I'm never going to have my work-life balance. And you can't see the positive changes that are going to occur. And if you look at people who, we'll say it, thrive under difficult circumstances over the long haul, they possess this really critical ability to both zoom in and zoom out. Which means occasionally you're going to go to the future and get some perspective and be like, hey, how will this look in, you know, 5 years? But they also can go the other way when their mind is dragging them to that place of like, oh, this is going to suck for a long time. They go the opposite route and they say, you know what? Forget all that. How do I get through the next 5 minutes, the next hour, the next day, the next week? And they have almost this faith of like, if I do that, eventually, like, I'm going to come out of this and things are going to change.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just reading some New York Times piece about difficult marriages, and it was saying something like people who were about to get divorced and then didn't, 5 or 6 years later, like 2/3 of them are actually happy or still happy. Like, so it's not the point that people who get divorced always regret it. Although, it was saying that most people who get divorced are not happier after they get divorced. Like they say that when they check in with the people who stayed married or got divorced, the people who got divorced are not necessarily happier. And a good chunk of the people who didn't get divorced and stayed married, stuck with the difficult thing, are actually in a better place, right? Which is, when we think about hard things, it's not just, hey, I run really fast or I push through. It's sticking through anything that's challenging you and understanding that usually you come out of the other side, having learned something, having adapted in some way, gotten some deeper understanding or perspective that makes you glad that you didn't quit when you had the opportunity to quit said thing.
Yeah. And I think the thing that is there is that often the quitting is the easiest choice.
Yes.
So we tend to, when we're in the thick of things, we tend to default towards the easiest path.
Yeah.
Because again, our brain is protective. It wants us to get out of that situation. It's in kind of flight mode where it says, oh, we feel anxiety or uncomfortable or whatever, like hit the eject button. And like that is one path that often what happens is like we regret because it's the simplest, easiest choice, but it's not always the right, wise choice.
Well, I get that because kids reach out to me all the time because they know that I'm a college dropout. And I think something I wrote like ranks well on like, should I drop out of college? I get like lots of emails about it. And I'm always like, how are you doing in school? Right? Because if you're quitting college because if you're dropping out of college because you are failing college, that is not the same thing as I'm leaving college to go do X, Y, or Z, right? Leaving college when you are failing is almost always the easier thing, right?
Right.
And the fact that you haven't been able to succeed at this hard thing makes me suspicious that you won't be able to do this harder thing, which is make it on your own without the piece of paper, without the support. Like if you can't muster the discipline to show up to classes, even when they don't matter, right? Like, if you can't figure out how to study for a test or game the system that is college, what makes you think you're going to be able to figure out the writing world, which is even more arbitrary, which has less of a safety net, which requires more bullshit and more daily discipline? Like, why do you think you're going to be able to do that discipline if you couldn't do the pretend discipline over here?
Yeah. And I think it, like, toughness to me comes down to that decision, right? That's what it's all about, is like you're sitting in this place where it's like, I could go to the left, I could go to the right. And inevitably we are drawn towards one because it makes our life easier. And in that case, like with the college, if the easy choice, because you're failing, quote unquote, failing and all of that stuff, the easy choice is to quit and then to rationalize it afterwards and be like, oh, I'm doing this because, college dropouts succeed and this, and I'm going to have all this motivation and stuff. Well, that's just the rationalization.
Yes.
And what I want people to do is to like sit in that decision and figure out what is the fake BS rationalization. And what is the actual difficult thing, right? If you're failing into college, the difficult thing is to say, okay, why am I failing in this environment? And can I turn it around? And to sit with that and ask that. And that's where I want more people to go towards. It doesn't mean it's always the right answer, but if you're, it's almost like going against the natural inclination to take the easy path and just like sitting and evaluating if the difficult path or if the other path is the right one, which often we just kind of, again, rationalize our way out of it so that we don't have to even think about that other path.
Do you think it's important to have a practice in which you cultivate that ability? Like, I think for me, like running or the physical training that I do, part of that is creating the muscle that allows me to go like, I didn't want to go for a run this morning and I went. I also don't want to take notes on this boring ass book that I read, but I know I need to for something I'm writing. But like, I'm the kind of person that easily and regularly does the things I don't want to do, not just if they're hard, but because they're hard.
I think it's absolutely a muscle that we have. It's a mental muscle. And I think the research backs this up, is that if we can train that discipline, that self-control, that ability to sit with that hard thing and navigate it, it helps in other aspects of our life.
And so how do you cultivate that in your life?
So in my life, a lot of it is around physical practice, right? In my own world, it's running. And I'll give you, you know, when I was growing up, I was a very competitive runner, and I don't push it that much anymore. But what I make sure that I do is that, in addition to, let's say, my easy running, at least once a week, I'm doing something where I'm pushing like the bounds of my physical ability. That could be going to a nearby hill and doing some sprints up and down it. It could be like, you know, I'm going to go out 4 miles and then turn around and try and run the last 4 miles like hard home. And I do that not because I'm trying to race. I don't race anymore or get in good shape. It's just because I want to be able to sit with that like situation where part of my mind is screaming at me to say, hey, like, you're not training for anything. Like, why don't you just slow down? Why don't you quit? You don't have to do this, and just like sit with it. And I think like physical aspects are great, but it can also, if I wasn't, you know, I think I do that because most of my work is more intellectual.
Sure.
And that gives that like natural, easy thing to do. But just like you as a writer, like, there are tons of things that I don't like about, you know, this business that I have to do. And I just, you know, try whenever it's almost like in certain aspects of my life, whenever I feel that like anxiety or that fear or that pull towards like, hey, you don't have to do that, that acts as a signal to me to sit there and be like, all right, maybe I should move towards this for a little bit. Maybe I should do this thing.
As a business owner who has my share of employees, I thought a lot about HR. It's not just enough to hire great people. You have to manage and develop and train those employees. You have to make sure they're comfortable, they're happy, that their needs are met, that you're following laws and best practices, or else you're just throwing money down the drain. And that's why today's sponsor, Bambi, is here to help small business owners implement good HR practices. Bambi is an HR platform built for businesses like yours. You can automate the most important HR practices and get your own dedicated HR manager. First, Bambi's HR autopilot automates your core policies, workplace training, employee feedback, and then your dedicated HR manager helps you navigate the more complex parts of HR, guide you to compliance, and they're available over phone, email, real-time chat. And look, this is a lot cheaper than an in-house HR manager, which can cost more than $80,000 a year. But with Bambi, your dedicated HR manager starts at just $99 a month. No hidden fees. Cancel anytime. You run the business. Let Bambi run your HR. Go to Bambi.com/stoic for your free HR audit. That's Bambee.com/stoic. Bambi.com/stoic.
Do you think that practice... Because I know you were one of the whistleblowers in the Alberto Salazar thing, which for people who don't know, maybe you can explain a little bit. But I imagine that was a difficult thing. I imagine that was a scary thing. I imagine it was a risky thing. And I imagine there were moments in it where you could have been like, you know what? I'm done. I did my part. I don't care about this anymore. Do you feel like cultivating the sort of physical practice also then translates to what we might call this sort of the more moral domain where we have to exhibit toughness?
Yeah, that's a great question. I do. So the brief rundown on that is I was a whistleblower in a case that saw anti-doping violations. So, you know, performance enhancing drug violations, and I blew the whistle, and U.S. anti-doping took, you know, investigated and found that there were violations. And that was one of the most difficult periods of my life. And it lasted almost 10 years.
Wow.
From the very beginning of like blowing the whistle to the final, you know, conclusion after appeals and all that stuff. And there were many, many moments where I thought about how my life would be easier if I just stepped back and checked out.
Yeah.
And in fact, like my parents, relatives, like all preferred that I went that path. They were like, this is not going to be easy. Like, you're going up David against Goliath. This won't end the way you think it will. So I do think that, like, this toughness is also wrestling with, like, that moral decisions. Because the easy decision, what is it there? Well, it's to stay quiet, shut up, and go about your life, because, like, your life will be better. My life is not, quote unquote, better because I blew the whistle. It is 100% not. But what I was forced to do is wrestle with, like, that discomfort of, well, if I choose the easy path, what's the result? Well, the result to me was other people would be put in the situation. Other Sure. people would potentially be harmed. Like, at that point, what really, you know, pushed me forward is I saw teenagers joining the team and what I saw. And I thought I was, like, in my mid-20s when I went through it. And in my head, I'm like, gosh, I can't imagine going through this and being in these situations as a 17, 18-year-old. Like, they're certainly not equipped if I wasn't equipped as a 26-year-old. And, like, those sorts of things, like, it's just like in navigating a physical discomfort. Half your brain is telling you take the easy route, and then you have to figure out, okay, but is the easy route the correct decision? Is that the one I want to live with? And I think having that physical practice, like, did help. Because and in fact, I know it did, because, like, whenever I had to do something hard around the case, like go in and, you know, give testimony and be grilled for, like, you know, 5-6 hours under oath, like, what did I go back to? I went back to, I'm feeling this anxiety. I'm feeling like I want to escape and I want to say no, but I need to navigate it. And how do I navigate it? I went back straight to my running. I was like, how do I get through these things? Just break it down.
Yeah, it's funny. We think that we support whistleblowers and we think we celebrate whistleblowers, which sometimes we do after the fact. And then we don't really realize what a grueling marathon it is. Like we do this all, like, oh, they're just doing this for money, or they're just doing this for attention or whatever. First up, there's almost never any money in it. Second of all, they're almost always would have preferred to just be able to do their fucking job and not have to do with this stuff. But, like, the amount of bureaucracy and setbacks and discouragement and collateral damage and punishment that goes into before the public even hears about it is usually so immense that I think people think, oh, I would do it. If I saw something wrong, I would do something about it. And they don't fully realize what it takes out of a person. And then that's why most of us don't do stuff like that.
Yeah, no, it's so emotionally draining. I mean, I wouldn't wish blowing the whistle on anybody, because it was emotionally draining to the max. Like, it impacted my relationships, my friendships, like, my environment. And in all honesty, also, it shifted kind of my personality for a long time, where I became, like, almost, like, timid and didn't want to, like, you know, put myself out there in any way. Because, like, I was going through this really challenging, hard time. So, you know, being a whistleblower is, it's not something anybody wants to do.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I had Alexander Vindman on the podcast, and mm-hmm. the amount of emails I got from people in the military that were like, oh, he just did it for X, Y, and Z. And I was just like, look, why don't you challenge the most powerful man in the world and then come back to me and tell me if you still think, you know, he did this for the following reasons, right? Like, it's just, I think we think of these moral acts as being, like, easy or default, but in a sense, they're as difficult an ordeal as running some insane mile time or lifting some absurd amount of weight. Like, it is not what we are meant to do, and it's certainly not what most people do.
right? By definition, like if everyone was a whistleblower, there would be no need for whistleblowers, right? Like, so the fact that everyone, like that many people saw the same thing and they were the only ones, or in your case, you're the only that did it, should give us some immediate bit of context that this was a hard thing to do. If it was easy, yeah. If it was easy, everyone would do it, right?
Exactly. We wouldn't need whistleblowers, and we wouldn't. And, you know, maybe to give context, I remember, so at the very beginning, when I was contemplating, you know, blowing the whistle, because it took me, you know, I sat on things for a good couple months before I said, okay, I have to do something. I remember talking to this like very esteemed like judge in my native Texas, and my parents, like, you know, they were the only ones who knew I saw anything, and they're like, why don't you talk to someone, like, here's this judge that we know, like, go talk.
Yeah.
And I remember him saying, Steve, the right thing to do is probably to speak up. But I've been on the bench in some high, you know, powered cases for like 40 years. And let me tell you, the whistleblowers like never benefit. They never come out like, you know, never come out on the good side. People will hate them. You'll go through very difficult things. And he's like, I'm not here to tell you what's right or wrong, but just know that and consider that before you come out. You're not going to be like some hero or whatever have you. And it was absolutely true. And I think that that framing really helped, because it did suck. And like part of what allowed me to, or what pushed me to take that step where others wouldn't, was I remember, you know, in fact, I read some of your Stoicism books back then on this. And then I was like, I just had to prepare for the reality that was about to approach. So I went through the exercise of what happens if I can never do the job that I went to school for? What happens if I have to pivot completely? What happens if I have to cut myself off from like these friends and colleagues I've formed in the workplace and in the environment I was in? What happens if, you know, I can't get jobs because I'm, you know, blackballed and like have to find another way to make money? And I went through all of those things just so that I knew, like, am I prepared for this? And am I still willing to do this? And it came down towards like, I knew from my conscience that I had to do it, and that I was prepared if I had to pivot, go a whole different direction, and, you know, again, couldn't make money for a while.
Well, and I think it's like, why are you doing this? If you're doing this thing for the rewards, if you're doing it because you think it'll be fun, if you do it because you think it'll be easy, you know, you're not going to make it through the valley of despair, as they call it. Like in the startup world, it's like you get the elation of your first media hit, and then they call it the trough of despair. And so if you're starting a company because you think it's going to be a great way to meet women, or because you think it's an easy way to make a lot of money, or blah, 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 you're not going to make it through the trough of despair, right? And so if it's the same thing, if you're running to win an award or to be recognized, you're not going to do the day-to-day training that you need to do when no one's watching. If you're doing it because you love it, if you're doing it because you want to see what's on the other side, if you're doing it, blah, 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 then you can do it. And so I think, like, I think about this with books, like I have something I have to say. That's why I'm doing it. If I didn't have to say it, I wouldn't say it, right? Like if it was optional, you wouldn't make it through the other side. And so I think if you're doing it because you have to, because you're asking yourself that question that Hillel said, like, if not me, then who, right? Like if you're asking yourself, if it's on some deeper level, then you have the toughness or the why that can get you through. And if you don't, you're just going to wilt, because like it doesn't make financial, economic, physical, it doesn't make sense. You know what I mean? The equation doesn't get you there.
Yeah, it's that meaning and purpose behind it. It has to be something deep. And I think that's what it, you know, whatever we're talking about, starting a company, writing a book, you know, blowing the whistle, is it has to be something that is powerful enough to get you through that trough of despair, to get you through the very difficult times, because if it's not, you're going to fade. And
so
go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was going to say, ironically, what we often try to do, though, is cultivate a motivation in younger people based on like the external, the rewards, like,
yes,
write this book so that like you can get more clients. And you and I know, like, if that's why you're starting to write a book, you're going to get halfway through and be like, this sucks, I'm not going to do it. So it's like that why, that deeper connection, like, has to be there. And that is often the fuel that gets us through really challenging times.
Yes, I think that's right. So the last thing I wanted to ask you about was, I'm glad that you brought up that Stoicism was something you looked at as you were doing this, because I think sometimes people think of Stoicism as one being sort of passive, or they think about it just as this thing that helps you do tough physical feats, like sort of being the emotionless robot, or, you know, the emotionally invulnerable person. But I like that it was something you turned to for the moral support necessary to do a thing that other people around you were saying, you know what, this might not be worth it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I remember reading, again, The Obstacle is the Way. I read Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, because like, and Marcus Aurelius was really kind of formative on that, because I remember reading that and being like, here is this person who is going through like leading an empire, essentially, through these challenging times. And he's having like some of these same doubts, the same insecurities, and then giving kind of a roadmap on like, here's how I think about it. Here's how I'm gonna, like, here's how I think about, you know, preparing for things. And that was, again, very powerful. And I remember that was kind of the thing that forced me to say, okay, like, what's the reality I'm preparing for? And am I okay going on that journey? And what does it mean to go on that journey? And I think this is where it, you know, at the beginning, we talked about the stories that we have in our heads on coaches and others that form, you know, how you approach difficult things. I think this is where, whether it comes from religion or Buddhism or Stoicism or whatever have you, a combination of this, is that really great thinkers have spent a lot of time like navigating these challenges. And what that does is those ideas, those philosophers, those thinkers, they almost give us good language and models for how to tackle these things. And it replaces the what I would call the cheap language and models of like modern society with something that is timeless and that has helped people throughout the world. And I think that, to me, is like one of the best things that something like Stoicism has done. And then also, as you know, I'm a big fan of your work, Ryan, is that like your work translating that to the masses has done as well, is it provides us with these mental models that are actually useful and that actually help us in the real world.
Well, I think that's an important point that you just made, which is that like whatever the hard thing you're trying to do is, whether it's make it through boot camp or start your own company or be a whistleblower or be a pioneer in some new field or whatever it is, someone has done some version of that hard thing before and probably written a book or more about that topic. And you're an idiot if you don't avail yourself of that very hard won knowledge. And yet that's what people do all the time for some insane reason.
Exactly. This is why, you know, to me, like reading, or if you want to listen or whatever, like books is the best thing that you can do, because you're taking someone's experience that was probably hard fought over years.
Yes.
And they're condensing it down to, these are the important points. This is what helped me get through this. And like, these are the lessons you can take away. And that's why whenever I'm going through, you know, something uncertain, I turn to reading. Like, and often, and the other advice I'd give to listeners is I do two things. Whenever I'm facing something challenging, I turn to reading, but I make sure I read something contemporary and then couple that with something that is, you know, hundreds or thousands of years old. Yes. So that hopefully you get that ancient wisdom. And then also, you know, hopefully you get something that maybe can apply or that is more applicable in context that is today.
And the third thing, though, I would add to that, and in some cases, this is the toughest thing for people to do, which is I would try to look around you and think of people you know or have access to who have also been through something like this and ask them for help, right? Like there's this great line in this book, The Boy, the Fox, the Horse, and the Mole that I like to read to my kids. Mm. And he says, asking for help isn't giving up. It's refusing to give up, right? And that sometimes we internalize toughness as going it alone, gutting it out, just taking it, when it may well be that somebody you know, like you have kids, well, you also have parents, right? And grandparents and aunts and uncles who have been in the shit that you are in right now. And you should avail yourself of that hard-won wisdom too, and don't be afraid to ask for help. And to go to where we opened this idea of being a good friend to yourself, when your friends ask you for help, you're not like, this guy again, you know? You're like, you're flattered, you know? Or it's interesting or exciting. You're like grateful for the opportunity to help. And then when we have problems, we're like, I don't want to bother anyone with this. It's totally irrational.
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think that is it. Like, again, what's the easy decision in those moments? It's just to put your head down and be like, oh, I'm not going to bother you.
Yes.
Often the tough decision is to be like, you know what? I'm going through something. I got to reach out. I got to get help. And this is also a place where I think mentors are invaluable, because they often have gone through the challenges that you're facing. So to have someone where you have that relationship where you can pick up the phone or have coffee with them and just be honest and open and get advice, I think that is, you know, that is the tough thing to do, but it's also the thing that will get you through really challenging times.
That's perfectly said, Steve. Look, I loved the book. I also loved Peak Performance, which I carry in my bookstore. And I really appreciate you writing this. And I hope we can do this again sometime.
Thanks so much, Ryan. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for listening. If you could rate this podcast and leave a review on iTunes, that would mean so much to us and it would really help the show. We appreciate it, and I'll see you next episode. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to the best one yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to the best one yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.